Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. Copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. In the last episode, the author was reflecting on the many non-native birds that inhabit her yard, such as starlings and sparrows. We resume Suburban Safari on page 206, and this is episode 20. And so I discover a world of sparrow-scaring devices, sparrow seed traps, and sparrow nest traps. As for dispatching bagged sparrows, the list of methods is long. Compress the chest for 30 seconds, grip the head and crack the bird like a whip, swing the sparrow in a bag against a solid object. Submerse the bag in water. Step on the bag. A bird researcher I once worked with taught me the chest-squeezing method, but I suppose he wanted his dead birds to look nice. Quicker is kinder, to my mind. I guess I'd opt for the solid object. Because the sparrows aren't native, it's perfectly legal to do them in. The same goes for pigeons and starlings. With West Nile loose upon the land, the English sparrow has cheated even higher on my list of enemies. The sparrow evolved in Eurasia, overlapping with the virus. His immune system can fight the bug, and he carries loads of the virus around in his blood for mosquitoes to tap into. Whomever a mosquito subsequently bites gets both a welt and an injection of West Nile. My crows are terribly susceptible to the virus, and here they are sharing a yard with those germy English sparrows. Ah! Like the European starling, the English sparrow was escorted to these shores by an optimistic human. The bird was supposed to control a canker worm, as it does in Europe. But as every city dweller knows, these fearless birds will eat anything from bagel crumbs to bologna. In 150 years, they have cheated their way across North America. And onward, like starlings, the sparrows have conquered much of the planet. Rather than protecting farmers from insects, the sparrows stuff themselves with grain. Why do some immigrants hit new territory running? Some successful invaders, such as starlings, who hunt on open ground, already specialized in exploiting a disturbed ecosystem. This served them well when they arrived on a continent being cleared for grazing and farming. Others may blossom in their new home because they managed to give the slip to some of their enemies when they left the old country. The black rat, for instance, left most of its parasitic worms at home when it emigrated from Europe. Without all the freeloaders, Rattus rattus has more energy to channel into reproduction. This dynamic may prove to be common among invasive species, allowing them to do even better in their new country than they did back home. A survey of 26 foreign invader animals finds that the newcomers are burdened by only half as many different parasites as native mammals are. The melting pot era isn't bygone, not by a long shot. Just 50 years ago, a southern African bee was imported to Brazil to breed heat tolerance into European honeybees. Oops, they got away. Now the hybrid bees, heat tolerant and hot-tempered to boot, are making niches for themselves all over the southern United States. In 1988, the zebra mussel invaded the Great Lakes, probably after being dumped with a ship's ballast water. It's now fouling, or biofouling, as biologists like to say, rivers and pipes across much of the eastern United States, from the Great Lakes to New Orleans. And 2002 saw the introduction of the voracious northern snakehead fish in a Maryland pond. As long as people have traveled, they've taken invasive animals with them. Now people are moving more than ever, and we continue to transfer animals from one continent to the next. Some invaders bring with them a redeeming quality. Starlings may pose a fatal threat to the red-headed woodpecker, but they're also an easy meal for predatory birds like my Sharpie. I had glanced out the dining room window just as the creamy ginger-speckled bird fanned his striped tail for landing. His claws clutched a wad of dark feathers. He touched down behind the chokecherry tree, but a few rounds of thrashing brought him into view. Through the window and a forsythia bush, I made out a hooked beak and a round eye. The head dipped briefly, and a small cloud of black feathers blew onto the lawn. He plucked quickly, one foot gripping the prey. He lifted his head after each pluck, looking left and right. After 5 minutes, I saw red flesh at his feet. Now he pecked, raised his head, and gulped as he scanned for danger. Every few minutes he rested, watchful. He fluffed his feathers, then resumed. He tugged at a string of intestine. He rotated on the carcass. A chickadee flitted near to Rubberneck. Somewhere a jay called, and the hawk listened. After 30 minutes, he was sated. He hopped to a low branch of the oak tree. One foot was blood-stained. He picked a feather from between his toes and spat it into the air. He rubbed his beak clean on an upright branch, then rubbed his cheeks. He shook his feathers. His crop bulged with meat. Then he was gone, fueled up for another day. Even the English sparrows, loathsome as they are, can reveal marvels of natural history. Thanks to them, I know that crows can sniff out concealed food. One day, when the sparrow racket was getting on my nerves, I took what was close to hand, large bean seeds I'd harvested from a past garden, and threw a fistful into the bushes. The sparrows scattered, and peace was restored. A couple of hours later, the crows came by for a kibble check. I soon realized that one crow was prospecting deep in the fallen leaves and shrubbery. Only once before had I seen a crow venture under the bushes. I perked up. The crow walked deeper into the shadows, poking among leaves with its beak. And then it bounded back into the sunlight with a prize, a bean. He pecked it apart and ate it. Half a dozen times he returned to the underbrush to dig out the seeds. As for invasive plants, I may have already found occasion to mention my hatred for bamboo and Asiatic bittersweet, but it wasn't until botanist Josh Reut conducted a tour of horror in my yard that I realized how bad the situation was. The bittersweet and bamboo are big, obnoxious, and hence obvious. Less obvious are the small intruders who already claim 99% of my yard. And that's in a freedom lawn, which gives natives a much better chance than a typical grass lawn does. For Josh, a botanist for the main chapter of the Nature Conservancy, the plant invasion is an act of war, and he's responding with similar spirit. "I'm going to invent a DNA blaster for bamboo," he said when he entered my yard earlier in the year and discovered the bamboo wilderness next door. "Something helicopter-based. You dial in the DNA for bamboo, or bittersweet, and zap, it wipes out the DNA." John's work for the Nature Conservancy entails thrashing around in various ecosystems to make sure a plot of land is worth conserving. If it's infested with foreigners, it's too late. Until the DNA blaster is available, he suggests that I might try chewing the bamboo into submission. "The shoots taste like celery," he says. Then he spots a sumac baby cowering in the shade of the bamboo. "Wow, it's not giving up," he says, crouching over the sprout. The magenta fuzz on a green stem has caught his eye. "Isn't that amazing?" It is. New leaves are unfolding in two tones, dark green, edged in purple. It's the most exotic-looking thing in my yard. "But it's not exotic," Josh says. "It's native." So is the aster, he notes, moving on around the perimeter, as are the grapevines that hang in the oak tree. Viking explorers didn't name this part of the world Vinland for nothing. But then we get into a bad patch. The Morrow's honeysuckle, imported by gardeners, is fiendishly invasive. The nightshade is foreign, so are the yellow hawkweed flowers and the quack grass. Reaching through the fence to pluck a leaf, Josh squeezes the stem. White sap comes out. Norway maple, he says, another major invasive. There's an exotic hop vine on the fence. Among my raspberries, which are native, he finds foreign vetch and orich. Ballast species, he calls them, because they probably arrived accidentally with the dirt ballast in ships. A native St. John's wort, he exclaims. It's a stick of a plant with mouse ear leaves. It lacks the antidepressant punch of its European cousin, but it brightens Josh's affect anyway. Heading back toward the house, we find white and red clovers, both introduced. I'm not sure we've got more natives than fingers yet, Josh says, but this could be another. He pulls up a spindly thing with prickly seed heads and stuffs it into his shirt pocket. The roots bob under his chin. Coming to the white pines I planted as a windbreak, Josh fingers the foliage. I chose the pines because they're native to my ecosystem, but I may have been swindled. I'm suspicious, he says. The needles are really long. I'm guessing it was grown in North Carolina and shipped to a nursery in Maine, so it's native with a wince. Less troubling are the native evening primroses I've allowed to multiply on the deck. Of course, they're surrounded by tulips from Central Asia, daylilies from Europe, peonies from China, and irises from Russia. Isn't there someplace else we could look? Josh pleads, looking back over the lawn. Maybe we could find one more native. Beside the driveway, he crawls under the forsythia hedge and hits the jackpot. He finds a probably native violet and a probably native sedge, a dark green plant I would have called grass. Into his pocket go a few threads of moss that might qualify. Out front, he buries his head in the privet hedge to examine a large leaf. Woo-hoo! He hoots from the depths. A native red maple and an American yew! Yay! His yellow shirt is speckled with bark, spider webs, and root dirt, and he's looking happier. There's one stem of native poverty grass in my front yard. The adjoining flower bed features three stalks of milkweed that I leave for the butterflies. And on the north side of the house, Josh finds a 6-inch blue spruce. It's not native to Maine, but it's North American at least. And that's all. Probably 40 non-natives, Josh concludes, and possibly 15 natives, all of them at risk of being destroyed by invasive species. That's the case all over the country. Invasives are the number two threat, actually. Number one is development and sprawl, which eliminates habitat altogether. As we head indoors to look up the mystery plants, Josh does a double take and marches across the street to a neighbor's lawn. Purple loosestrife, he says, aiming a finger at a tall, spiked flower stalk. It gets out of people's gardens, and it destroys wetlands. He stops short of tearing out the flowers and sighs. Knowing what I know takes some of the fun out of just enjoying the landscape, he says. Many of the showy plants that run roughshod over North America were brought here intentionally, and the comparison between, say, Asiatic bittersweet and peonies illustrates an important difference between a successful invasive and a docile garden plant. Peonies are fussy. They don't spread. They sometimes sulk for years, refusing even to bloom. But bittersweet couldn't be easier to please. Give it a millimeter, and it'll take a mile. Asiatic bittersweet is one of the plants that need a disturbed landscape. If a bird should evacuate a bittersweet seed under a forest canopy, that seed won't find enough light to grow. End of story. But if the seed falls in a spot with no overhanging trees, a road shoulder, the edge of a parking lot, or most of my neighborhood, it's off and running. It will carve out a new territory for its own seeds by twisting around neighboring plants and choking them. As the years go by, the bittersweet dynasty will spread across the land by throttling tree after tree. Birds will aid the vine by distributing seeds. Another advantage bittersweet has over peonies is that bittersweet left more of its diseases back home in East Asia. So while peonies spend energy battling the same old fungi and viruses, the bittersweet feels as though a weight has been lifted from its shoulders. Up it goes! Research has found that the average invasive plant outran 3/4 of its fungal and viral persecutors when it emigrated to North America. I can't dig up any evidence that bittersweet poisons the soil against other plants, though that is a strategy of some invasive plants. Spotted knapweed, a pretty purple thing from Europe, wins territory in North America by releasing a toxin into the soil. It has evolved immunity to its own poison, as have its old neighbors back in the old country. North American plants, however, have evolved no defense against this chemical warfare, which erodes their roots. They fall back in defeat, opening more space for the knapweed. With all its other advantages, bittersweet doesn't really need chemical weapons. It kills by twining. It grows at a speed that's nearly visible. It produces bushels of seeds, which birds adore. Suckered by the beauty of the fruit, people, too, help bittersweet spread by clipping branches for indoor display, then dumping them outdoors. Bittersweet has what it takes. So does the bamboo and the Norway maple. Which gets me thinking about what might happen if I stopped beheading and uprooting the invaders. What would happen if everybody stopped controlling these colonizers and allowed the suburbs to go wild? In ecosystem science, succession describes the order in which plants colonize ground that's been cleared by fire or farming. In my yard, a simplified version of succession might go like this if only native plants were allowed to play. Goldenrod, milkweed, and raspberries would rule first. They'd be shaded out by white pines. Gradually, hardwoods would mix with evergreens to form the climax population. But that couldn't happen now, not without a human patron. If I quit chopping down the invasives, I think the result would be a bloody competition between Asiatic bittersweet, Norway maples, and Japanese bamboo. Each is especially equipped for the fight. It would be fascinating to watch. Both the maples and the bamboo open their leaves early in the spring to shade out the competitors. Bittersweet leafs out later, so it would need to exploit the edges and openings. Bittersweet would also have to compete with the aggressive roots of the Norway maples, which form a dense mat just under the surface. But bittersweet's roots are equally formidable, spreading 10 or 20 feet to suck nutrition from the soil. The bamboo, too, would have to avoid the shade of the maples. But it also has roots that bore great distances underground to push up new shoots. So maples and bamboo would each shade out competitors under their foliage. Around the edges, bittersweet would rise up, climbing the bamboo stalks. Unable to reach the maples directly, the vines would stretch from the top of the bamboo to the low branches of a tree. It would ascend, choking branches as it climbed, until it blanketed the south side of the tree, stealing the sunlight. The tree would die and fall. Bittersweet and bamboo would race to colonize the sunny spot. And perhaps a stalemate would ensue, with bittersweet gaining 1 year and bamboo surging back the next. In my kitchen, Josh and I look up the mystery plants in Newcomb's Wildflower Guide, identifying one more native and two invasives. As he leaves, a flock of starlings swirl off the telephone wire and heads to the backyard. I'm going to invent something for starlings, too, Josh says. It could also be helicopter-based. You fly around, and when you find one of those big flocks, you fire it off. It's sponsored by a dog food company that grinds up the starling meat. Nice, I say. Does it come with an English sparrow attachment? Lawn is a four-letter word. Maureen Austin's fashionable toes weave down a bark mulch trail in a friend's backyard. Not a blade of grass mars the landscape. Maureen, a tall California blonde, flicks her fingers hither and yon. Bottle brush, that's a great hummingbird plant, and migrating tanagers love it too. Fennel is the food plant of the swallowtail butterfly. Buddleia is a butterfly shrub, of course. Once again I've sallied forth from my yard, this time wandering as far as the hills east of San Diego. For 30 years, the National Wildlife Federation has been urging lawn owners to make their yards animal-friendly. Maureen's town, Alpine, California, was the first to accept the challenge as a community. NWF has certified the entire city as a backyard wildlife habitat. Some 200 individual lawn owners now participate. Maureen, with her gardener's tan and gritty fingernails, led the way. And now she has channeled the momentum into a job doing, well, being Maureen. From what I can gather, she's a garden diva who circulates and educates and organizes for Mother Nature. I must come clean. I have doubts about the wildscaping concept. My concerns are twofold. First, as is evident in my yard, it's easy to attract invasive plants and animals. I don't want to make life any easier for the English sparrows. Second, I can't find many studies of wildscaping's effectiveness, and some minor ones I do find suggest it's not a panacea. I'm not ready to act on my doubts. At home, I leave my dead wood and brush at the yard edges for the fungi and the beetles, as instructed. I'm nursing a patch of milkweed and hope that a monarch caterpillar will someday suspend himself there in gold and green chrysalis. In grape season, I seed all fruit rights to the catbirds and cardinals. While I do believe it helps, I'm uneasy with the notion that putting out food and water and growing dense shrubbery will automatically aid nature. I think it's going to require a heavier hand than that to beat back the aggressive invasive species. But I've come to Alpine for a first-hand view of wildscaping. Maybe it was a bad idea. When I step out of the car, I don't recognize the bird songs. I haven't a clue which grasses are native and which are invasive. Even the crows seem unfamiliar with faster wing beats and higher voices. On the phone, Maureen had suggested I spend the morning investigating downtown. So I poke around a hotel that has a backyard habitat and a parking lot with a habitat island. The hotel is adrift in flowery landscaping. It smells great, but it doesn't look wild to me. I don't see any birds. The parking lot island in the asphalt features some sage, grasses, and flowers. It even hides a miniature pond in which a plastic bag and a detergent bottle cap marinate. English sparrows squawk. But did I really expect to find hummingbirds in a parking lot? I meet Maureen at her Habitat Hut shop, right on the main drag of town. Behind the hut is an urban jungle of trees and shrubs that is indeed all aflitter with insects and birds. Maureen bundles me into her truck to visit a few of her favorite yards. She came to this project through gardening, she tells me while we drive through town. Her organic herb garden became so famous that she found her days consumed with garden tours. And people were saying, "Wow, where did you get all those birds? How do you get these butterflies? I don't have bees in my garden." I said, "Man, this is sad that people have never seen a butterfly in their yard." Her mission was born. One backyard habitatter I spoke to said he'd watched in disbelief as Maureen rallied the town. "I thought no way could she do it here," the gardener said. "Alpine's funky. We don't interact too much with our neighbors." But 100 people came to the first meeting that Maureen advertised. And in 1998, Alpine became the first town to win the NWF's town-wide certificate. Maureen and I step out of the truck at Marilyn and Ed Wojak's spread, and a cacophony of birdsong washes over us. I recognize none of them. We've had blue-headed grosbeaks, lazuli buntings, western tanagers, a diamond dove, says Marilyn, who moves with that mixture of grace and stiffness that marks the mature gardener. So many birds I lose count. as we bob and duck around towering specimens of bird of paradise, jasmine, and asparagus fern, my head bonks a series of net bags stuffed with finch seed. Bird baths glimmer in the shadows and even in the vegetable patch. On a back fence grows a passion vine bearing zany white and maroon flowers. Marilyn and Maureen bend their heads in search of a painted lady caterpillar to take back to the Habitat Hut's butterfly garden. Marilyn produces one of the spiked orange and purple creatures and hands it to Maureen on the leaf. Maureen coos over the larva and names it Gloria. With Gloria running wild in the back seat of the truck, we roll on. The next garden is less shady. Lizards spray grit as they whip out of the way. Crows bray in the neighboring pasture. Farther off, peacocks squeal. The gardener is not at home, but Maureen leads me through a miniature orchard, a cactus garden, and a wilderness of wildlife-pleasing flowers and shrubs. At a third garden, we're met by Elma Terry, an elderly woman in a lilac pantsuit and amethyst jewelry. We admire her new water feature, a man-made stream that splashes into a pool of goldfish. Again, Maureen rattles off the dozens of useful plants she sees in the garden. "Which butterflies go for the butterfly bush?" Elma asks as we wander in the heat. "All of them," Maureen smiles. On the way back to town, Maureen takes me to the Viejas Mall, an Indian-run outlet center. A false river runs through the entire site, babbling in and out of pools and off false boulders. Tall grasses wave in the wind, and sculptures of native animals decorate the stone and concrete. It's half a million times nicer than any mall I've ever seen. Yet I doubt. The people I've met seem to be, first and foremost, gardeners. The animals that visit their gardens seem like an afterthought. A bonus. The NWF's habitat planning guide weighs on my mind, too. Using pesticides isn't forbidden in a certified backyard habitat, only discouraged. Cats aren't required to be kept indoors. Wildscaping for insects rates a mild suggestion, yet even the babies of seed-eating birds have to eat insects to grow. I'm in no position to throw stones. Look at my yard. It's a freedom lawn, yes, but it's much too much freedom lawn. Of the few shrubs that provide precious cover for birds, the majority are infested with a murderous gang of English sparrows. Hey, who do I think I am? Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of The Maine Reader. We're reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. This is The Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.